The Guardian.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, drag and drop tools, and 24/7 support. Squarespace also offers seamless e-commerce solutions for you or your small business. Every design automatically includes a unique mobile experience that matches the overall style of your website, so your content will look brilliant on any device. Start your free trial today. No credit card required. As a Guardian podcast listener, you'll get 10% off your new account by using the offer code Guardian.
Hello, this is Politics Weekly. I'm Tom Clark. Britain is a Christian country, so says David Cameron. What does that mean and why has it provoked such reaction? Also this week, 26 million people are looking for work in Europe and they want to take your job. A new UKIP poster campaign gets no marks for subtlety and few for accuracy, but will it work for the party? Joining me for all of this we have The Guardian columnist Martin Kettle, our political diarist Hugh Muir, and an associate with the Demos think tank with a special interest in progressive conservatism, Max Wind-Cowie. A warm welcome to you all. Now, there was a time when stating that Britain was a Christian country would have been so obvious as to be unnecessary, let alone controversial. But when David Cameron said just that, he provoked a backlash led by 50 prominent public figures, including Simon Singh, Peter Tatchell and Terry Pratchett. Britain, they said, was largely an irreligious place, and all the better for it. Hugh, do you think that the Prime Minister's tapping some kind of nostalgic yearning here for politicians who aren't shy about declaring their faith, or do you think he's up to something else?
I think there's two things here. I think you've got to look at the message and then you have to look at the messenger. The message is kind of obvious, really. If he'd said this is a country whose fundamentals are based on Christianity, then I don't think anyone would be able to have an argument with him, because I think that's palpably true. If you look at the structure of the establishment, if you look at how the Church of England is tied into that, the Queen is the head of Church of England, then, you know, if you're looking at a textbook and how the country works, then that's clearly right. Then you've got to look at the messenger and say, well, why is he doing this? And clearly it's quite a neat way of being able to kind of draw off the kind of UKIP light contingent, because when he talks about this being a Christian country, I think he's aiming at something. I think there's a reason for the timing. I don't mind the debate. And one of the things I resent, actually, when we do this and when we talk about this, is that we always talk about this in the context of crisis management. It becomes the fact that he said it becomes the story, when in fact I think this is the kind of debate we should be having anyway. I think, you know, we probably have enough ministers. I think we should have a minister for cohesion, and I think we should be talking about exactly this sort of thing, because we don't have that conversation.
But do you think it's principally about saying we're a Christian country, as in we're not a Muslim country, which seemed to be what Eric Pickles was saying when he said we're a Christian country, get over it?
Yeah, I suspect
excellent impression.
I think he was winking at the time, not Eric, the Prime Minister, because yes, I think that it was an appeal to people who might be tempted to go to UKIP to say, look, you don't really have to. We kind of are of like mind, and there are bits, we know there are bits of UKIP you don't really like, so you can stay with us because we're broadly of the same view as you.
But you see it as a good conversation opener, essentially.
I think it's a conversation we should have.
I absolutely agree. It is a conversation we should have. I mean, I really don't like the, much as I appreciate that it's perfectly natural, I really don't like the cynicism about David Cameron's motives. He was giving an Easter message at Easter. He is a Christian. He's an Anglican. He absolutely is right to say that Britain is a country which, I mean, the vast majority of us identify as Christian, even if we're not church-going, avid evangelical believers. And David Cameron has talked about his faith for the entirety of his leadership. It just so happens that people are suddenly quite interested in it. Saying that this is a Christian country is not about saying to UKIP voters that, don't worry, we secretly hate Muslims. That's absolutely not what he's saying. And actually, if you think about religious minorities in this country, aside from Christians, and what their view on Britain is, and their view of what Britain's Christian heritage lends them in terms of their freedom to worship, in terms of the respect that they're given in the public sphere, as a religious denomination. Actually, this is not about being divisive against people of other faiths. The only division here is a division between people who broadly accept that Britain is a kind of Christian country. As you say, its fundamentals are quite Christian. Actually, Christian values massively affect how our public discourse happens, and people who really, really resent that. And actually, the list of public figures who, you know, wrote their letter being terribly, frightfully annoyed with David Cameron for having talked about Britain being a Christian country, I think came across as actually being really rather silly about it. It came across as being, so, you know, a desperate attempt to start some kind of culture war where there is none.
Do you think, Martin, that David Cameron, because I agree with Max on that, you know, he was trying to counterpose Britain against somewhere like France, where you have officially you have secularism, but then you have a more sort of strident line against Islam in a way. But do you think we can take David Cameron's faith seriously? He's in the past agreed with Boris Johnson that it comes and goes like a Magic FM reception in the Chilterns, in a very high Tory phrase.
Yes. Well, I'm so deeply relaxed about this issue, I'm almost falling off my chair. I just think, as Max says, David Cameron has been completely consistent about his profession of his faith. That's fine by me. I don't think it matters one way or another. I don't think it affects the way in which he is perceived as a politician. I also agree that I don't think this was some sort of devious, well-planned thing on the grid where we the Tories are suddenly going to make a pitch for UKIP voters. I don't see UKIP sort of contesting that territory at least on the faith side of things, and I'm not aware that's a feature of UKIP internal debate. I mean, obviously there is an immigration dimension to any discussion of faith in this country today, but I mean, and you're right, Hugh, that it's a discussion that's necessary and positive and good to have. I think, frankly, this is a bubble issue. I think, you know, I think it's silly that politicians feel the obligation now almost written into their diary that they have to have an Easter message or a Christmas message or a New Year message. These things seem to me to be banal. I think the country can manage without them, and I don't think
Christians can manage without them.
I think the absence of them has not created consternation in the past. So I'm, you know, as I say, I really don't think it's a big issue, except for journalists.
Nick Clegg and Ed Miliband, who are both avowed atheists, quite unusually amongst political leaders, are completely upfront about being atheists. Did they do messages? I missed them.
Well, they did at Christmas and they do at New Year. I mean, for no good reason that I can see. I don't think the fact that we may or may not have an atheist prime minister, or even more interestingly, historically, a Catholic prime minister, which we nearly did at one point, is something that disturbs the country.
I love you both for many reasons, and one of which is your complete lack of cynicism. Does that mean then that you think that when they used that wording, they thought it was completely innocuous, and that they're completely surprised now that we're having this debate about that element of that speech?
Well, I think that if any of us is having that debate, we might well slip into saying this is a Christian country without implying it's not a country which is open to all faiths and none, including Muslims and, you know, including Jedi Knights.
But why was that phrase there, and why was it so worded? That speech would have been pored over. They would have spent a long time on it. And do you think that they did not know that, that wording it in that way would cause this debate? I'm not saying it's a terrible debate. I'm not saying we shouldn't have it.
No, I know, but I mean, you bestow a huge amount of kind of strategy on David Cameron, where I suspect there is none. And
that's a problem in itself.
That's a really interesting question.
It wasn't a speech. It was an interview with the Church Times, I think. And so you're in a conversation. You're talking, obviously, about Christianity because you're talking to the Church Times. And when asked, you know, what you think about Christianity's influence and role in British public life, you know,
David Cameron, to the vestry a bit when you talk to the Church Times.
David Cameron is a Christian and a conservative. It is perfectly natural that he, like I, thinks that that Britain is a Christian country, and that in many ways that has been an immensely positive legacy and tradition that has been left to us.
And it should just be added, I mean, he is not an evangelical in any sense, as far as I understand it, and certainly not in the political sense. I don't think this is a culture wars thing. I don't think it's got any Tea Party analogy. I don't think it's got any George W. Bush analogy. It's not about going down on his knees and praying for guidance.
Well, he's not Tony Blair
on the future. he is not Tony Blair.
But is there because obviously he's not Tony Blair. Religion doesn't shoot through his life in the same way. But he is worried, isn't he, about how a lot of religious people who are conservatives, who are a bit more evangelical about it, are feeling after the gay marriage issue. Do you think?
Yeah, I think it's absolutely the case that the same-sex marriage caused huge amounts of disruption and argument and disagreement and disappointment amongst many conservative grassroots members, some of whom will have based their opposition to it on their Christianity, some of whom, frankly, that wasn't the factor that made them oppose it. I think, you know, looking at David Cameron kind of holistically and what he's done in government and what he's pronounced upon and what he clearly feels is important, he does have a kind of archetypal Anglican approach to Christianity and to politics. And that is not going to satisfy either kind of the Richard Dawkins of this world, who are terribly, terribly upset about the idea of someone in public office talking about faith, but nor will it satisfy the more aggressively evangelical, slightly more Americanized activists who believe in a version of Christianity and in Christianity's influence on politics, which would be kind of anathema to David Cameron and to most Anglicans.
I mean, there was this line in his intervention that really summed it up, which is something like many Church of England members, I'm a bit fuzzy on some of the nostrums of my faith.
Yeah. David Cameron's catechism has not been complete, I think it's fair to say.
I think the problem he's going to have now is that, he's been he's fairly casual, as you say, he's not evangelical about it, but after this, he's probably going to have to go to church a bit more. And we may well be ringing on Monday morning each week to find out if you went to church.
He does go to church on Thursday mornings.
Yeah, he does.
But this is the really embarrassing thing about that interview is not him talking about, you know, England being a Christian country or whatever. It's the fact that he confessed that he goes to church on Thursday mornings in his children's school's chapel, which I imagine that for most parents is something of an unusual idea.
Well, let's leave that there and move to more earthly and indeed more earthy matters. The European elections are being treated by many voters as a chance to give the established parties a bit of a kicking without too many consequences. This year, some, although not all pollsters, are predicting that the mood is now hostile enough to mean that Nigel Farage's UKIP will win the most votes. But is the party ready for the amount of scrutiny that would bring? This week, a poster campaign suggested that 26 million people from across the EU are lining up to take our jobs. And another showed a British construction worker begging on the streets with the caption, EU policy at work. Martin, they're famous for being a party of eccentrics and sometimes proud of that. And they like to be seen as straight talking. Does this go beyond that?
I think it goes a bit beyond where they've been before, because I think even if they don't win the election, and as you say, some polls say they will and some polls say they won't, and it's a month away, I think they haven't been as strong as this before in any nationwide election, and that is obviously significant. At the same time, one shouldn't say they've come from nowhere, because they haven't. Nigel Farage has been in the European Parliament since 1999. UKIP has been winning seats and being a factor in British politics, in European elections in particular, for most of the intervening period, sometimes strong, sometimes weak. So it's there. UKIP's appeal is obviously a matter of some concern to the Labour Party as well as to the Conservative Party. And that perhaps is the big change this time around. Whether that means that UKIP, however exactly well it does in a month's time, is a major factor in the general election, I'm less certain. It hasn't been so really in the past. It's a free kick. this election. Sadly, I always think that the British should take much, much, much more serious interest in advancing British interest in the European Union, even from outside the Eurozone. And you know, there's a proper debate to have about Europe in the general in the European election, which isn't simply a Manichaean thing about in or out. But that debate never takes place, so it's not going to happen this time either. And I think we're basically looking at something which is going to have some serious impact within the political class, but whether it's a big sea change for the country as a whole politically, I'm more sceptical.
Max, the mood in the Conservative Party seems to be that if UKIP does very well, of course we don't know how well it's done, it's going to do until next month, but if it does do well, a lot of Conservatives are going to be saying that that should have a big bearing on how David Cameron should run his election campaign, don't you think?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of Conservatives fundamentally misunderstand why UKIP is popular. And so they look at the, you know, elements of policy detail that seep through the kind of miasma of Farage's bandwagon, and they say, oh, look, they like a flat tax. That can appeal to working-class voters because working-class voters vote for them. And it's nonsense. It's absolute nonsense. The Conservative right is always looking for excuses to return to kind of Thatcherite economics of the 80s. And UKIP provides them with cover for advocating for that. And it is completely the wrong lesson to take. The reason that UKIP are popular and the reason why their poster campaign, offensive as people in kind of
Guardian
leafy
Towers.
London and on Twitter might find it, will not do them a shred of harm and may do them some good, is that UKIP talks, albeit they don't have the detail and they don't have the policy to do so, but UKIP talks about protecting people from globalisation. They talk about acknowledging the pain and the fear and the shock of being part of what David Cameron gleefully talks about as being the global race. And actually, if the Conservative Party really wants to learn a lesson from UKIP about how you appeal to working class voters, it's not that actually you can get away with smuggling in Thatcherite economics. It's that actually people want to be protected and defended from what they see as an incredibly remote and incredibly powerful force in their lives, which is not the EU. The EU is a nice badge to attach to it, but which is globalisation, and people feel absolutely robbed. And the right lesson for the Conservative Party to take from it, ironically, is that the modernisation of the Conservative Party did not go far enough. And the fact that we have very, very senior people who are talked about as the, you know, the future of the Conservative Party, who go on and on and on about the global race and competitiveness, etc., as though should you fall over in that global race, really that's all your fault, I think is the lesson that we need to learn. Modernisation needs to move into economics.
But at the same time, it's not for responsible politics to offer to people protections that they actually can't deliver on. And a lot of the protections that Nigel Farage would claim to be able to deliver, he just can't. I mean, the ad is a classic example. He says, you know, there are 26 million people who are after your job, and that's basically every unemployed person in Europe and who are not going to come to Britain. So that's just factually incorrect.
But it's irrelevant. All kinds of things in politics are factually incorrect. You know, I'll ring-fence the NHS. I mean, there's all kinds of pledges that you make or suggestions that you make in politics which are speaking to emotions rather than speaking to practice.
And I don't mind that, but that is just that's just so absurd that it's basically a lie.
But
it can't
it's
happen.
But it doesn't feel absurd to people who feel that their jobs have been taken.
But that's why an honest politician will always struggle against someone who's basically prepared to stretch the truth to that extent.
But isn't what he's saying is that there's 26 million people who could come after your job.
And, which is entirely
factually
correct.
I'm the only politician in Britain who's going to, you know, pull up the drawbridge so that they can't.
But that's a ridiculous statement to make. I mean, it's far too broad, and I think it does stretch credulity in politics, and I think it's one of the reasons that people are perhaps sceptical of politicians, because it's taking the political argument onto an absurd plane. And I think that we actually, as the media and certainly within politics, have a responsibility here and some culpability here, because particularly in the media, we're only now looking at UKIP properly. I've been writing about the various things about UKIP, about the nasty types they're in hock to in Europe, the fact that they say that they're anti-Europe, but they don't actually do anything very much to oppose Europe. They don't go, they don't critique what it's doing very much. There are actually technical, practical levels on which people could have challenged UKIP a long time ago, and they just didn't.
I think all of that is true, but at the same time, one shouldn't get too apocalyptic about what is about to happen. You know, I think it's clear that whilst other countries in Europe, some of them have a calmer and more reasoned and objective debate about this, the European policy as against that European policy, and the usual kind of nuances of, in the middle ground than we do. But you know, they're just as vulnerable to the populist, you know, plague on all their houses, anti-politics position. But actually, it's quite interesting how, you know, those things come, but they also go. I mean, I'm very struck looking, for instance, at Italy. You know, look at the Italian general election a year ago. You know, Grillo comes along and he completely sweeps the whole system off the board. Where is he now? I mean, a lot of people support him at some level because they're fed up with austerity and a downturn and with bureaucracy, and in the Italians' cases having to pay taxes. But, you know, in the end, these things can, you know, they are bubbles, I think, more often than not. And that's even true in what is true, you know, a more serious example, which is the National Front in France, you know, which I think is a more troubling example. But even that, you know, it comes and it goes, and even when Jean-Marie Le Pen got into the presidential final round a few years ago, he did it by getting 20% of the vote, and the socialists got 19%, and that was the reason Le Pen got into the final round, where he got humiliated. So I think we just have to be a little bit kind of not relaxed, but a little bit more objective.
I absolutely agree with some of these things.
I'm not saying you're not being objective.
No, I do think that you do have to have an infrastructure, and essentially they don't have an infrastructure. I think they will do well, but they won't do well enough at the next election to enable them to build another infrastructure. They're still at the whim of a few people with lots of money. And also, if Nigel Farage were hit by a route master tomorrow, that would probably be the end of this bubble.
Well, I don't know. Paul Nuttall's quite impressive. The thing about individuals with lots of money is very interesting, because the particular poster, the 26 million people after your job poster, was paid for by a UKIP donor who insisted on keeping editorial control over what the poster said and how it was displayed, which is absolutely bizarre. I mean, even in the Conservative Party, of which I am a proud member, you don't get to write your own election posters just because you happen to have given them. So
if Len McCluskey was to demand the same
outraged,
right over,
they would rightly be outraged.
Yeah. Okay. Well, finally, this week, man in particular will be swatting up on British political campaigns at the moment. David Axel. Rod, the man who was behind two successful presidential campaigns for Barack Obama, is heading across the Atlantic to sprinkle some stardust, or to try to, on Ed Miliband. Martin, you've watched a couple of presidential campaigns from Washington. They're rather different from general elections, but do you think Ed Miliband's right to assume the same basics apply and Axelrod's his man?
I think really this reflects the fact that it's very difficult to win a general election, and it's worth investing quite a lot of money if you're a political party in trying to do so in current circumstances. So, I mean, I don't think Axelrod is somebody who and as you say, sprinkle magic dust or whatever over it. I think he's somebody who's very good at maximising the returns at the margins. You know, what he did more than anything else was to pursue a multifaceted strategy to get the vote out by appealing to a significant set of demographics in the American electorate on behalf of Obama. Now, I mean, you know, Ed Miliband is not Barack Obama in either the good sense or the bad sense, I think. He's just very different kind of marketing proposition. And I don't think it means that, you know, Axelrod's going to kind of bring loads and loads of razzmatazz. I think he's a hardworking political consultant, and that's how he should be seen.
Machine.
I think that's basically how he should see it. Can I just say, I think it's pathetic, though, that the British political class is so in hock to American political consultancy that these things are necessary. All this could be done domestically.
All those poor British Labour Party staffers left out of work because of David Axelrod.
Linton Crosby and Jim Messina, another Obama man who's working for Cameron now, isn't he?
There is almost nobody in Westminster who doesn't want to be in the West Wing, and that's a very embarrassing and faintly kind of gauche truism. But what I think is underlyingly true about all of this, though, is, I mean, it's a bit like asking kind of brand manager for Fortnum & Mason to take over marketing Lidl. It's kind of complete nonsense to imagine that the job that David Axelrod had of selling Barack Obama to the American people resembles in any way, shape or form the job that the Labour Party has of selling Ed Miliband. And that's not because just because Ed Miliband lacks certain things like, you know, the charisma and the backstory, etc., of Barack Obama. It's also because fundamentally, the way in which British elections work, the way in which British voters will vote, it just works on a different mechanism to in the US. And I was talking to somebody who does lots and lots of polling the other day, and he was explaining that, you know, actually we all are obsessed with this idea of kind of pitting David Cameron against Ed Miliband and this kind of increasingly presidential notion of politics, because that's more fun for us as political writers or as people who work in politics. But that genuinely is not how the British electorate votes. And actually, according to this chap who has the numbers, it is far, far better in British elections to enter those elections being behind your party in terms of your personal polling being behind how popular your party is, than it is to enter elections as David Cameron will, being much, much more popular than your party. Because somewhere deep down, the British electorate remember that we are a parliamentary democracy and not a presidential
system. That's going to be a matter of degree, though, isn't it? And it's how much you're lagging behind your party and whether or not you're actually a millstone on your party. And I suspect that if there's an advantage to having Axelrod, then it's someone who is used to dealing with personality elections, and he might be able to finally figure out that Miliband, in terms of personality, how you pitch him. You clearly can't pitch him like you would an American candidate, because he's not that strong a personality. But I'm sure that this won't be the first time Axelrod had a candidate where you think, well, yeah, there are huge flaws here. We have to work our way through the flaws. But at least he will have some understanding of the importance of the personality issue.
And in the week, Martin, when David Moyes's departure has...
he's on the market.
There's a segue.
Well, he's on the move.
Maybe Axelrod can help him.
He can help the Liberal Democrats, maybe. But
what do you know? I don't know.
No, but what does it say about players on the one hand versus managers, backroom people on the other? I mean, it seems to me that we're putting an awful lot of faith in back office staff to be able to come in and move players around, political players around, to do different things.
I guess that's true. I mean, you know, you do have to say that in the end, what a party stands for is the thing that people recognise, just as the anonymous poll expert was saying to Max. And I think that is right. The presidentialism can be exaggerated, but it's important. I think it was unquestionably quite important in 1992 that Neil Kinnock suddenly felt in the spotlight like somebody who people were unhappy with the prospect that this man might be prime minister, and so you know they even preferred John Major, who was not, after all, the most charismatic figure in British political history, to that. I just think in this country, political campaigning is, on the whole, extraordinarily amateur still compared with what happens not just in America but in many other countries. The big exception to what I've just said is Scotland. And I'm not going to open up the Scottish question, but part of the SNP's brilliance is its machine. And if, you know, really, Ed Miliband should have looked at the SNP, and they should have stolen one or two guys from up in Edinburgh.
Well, on that heretical thought, we will draw things to a close for this week. My thanks to Martin Kettle, to Hugh Muir, and to Max Windcowie. The producer was Phil Maynard. I'm Tom Clark, and thanks very much indeed for listening.